From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM. Later tonight, those open lines and a special tribute to the late Brad Steiger. Here's what's happening. Anguish, frustration swirled through the Bahamas today as the government has now raised the death toll from Hurricane Dorian to 30, but they say that number could climb significantly higher. Thousands are missing. Thousands are missing. After raking the Outer Banks of North Carolina on Friday, Hurricane Dorian also raced through the Atlantic Ocean on a path that might take the storm across Nova Scotia on Saturday. The forecasters with the National Hurricane Center said the Category 1 hurricane will pass the southeastern New England area on Friday and Saturday. It's amazing how quickly that storm went from a Category 5 to a 1. Maybe we had something to do with that, but the Bahamas, they took it all with a Category 5. Japan is set to dump contaminated Fukushima water into the ocean as their storage has run out. The plant suffered a catastrophic meltdown in 2011 when a 6.6 magnitude earthquake shook that region. Vladimir Putin warning the U.S. once again that Russia would develop missiles previously banned under a landmark nuke forces treaty if it learns that we, the United States, has begun building them itself. Well, I don't think we will. U.S. health officials again urged people to stop vaping until they figure out why some are coming down with serious breathing illnesses. Officials have identified about 450 possible cases, including as many as 5 deaths in 33 states. The count includes newly reported deaths in California, Indiana, and Minnesota. No single vaping device, liquid, or ingredient has been tied to all the illnesses. Many of the sickened, but not all, were people who said they were vaping THC. Now, that's the chemical that gives marijuana its high, and many are teenagers. We thought we'd assign Dr. John Curtis, onlinecolumnist.com, to this story. John, I'm not a smoker, so I don't understand the vaping, but is it that dangerous?
Well, I think, you know, it depends. In the old drug days for people, we all know that different products were laced into various drugs. So, for instance, if somebody were taking, like, a psychedelic drug like LSD, and it happened to be laced with PCP or, you know, a methamphetamine or some other substance, it could create a very bad experience for somebody. The same thing is true with weed. We know that for years, weed has been adulterated with many different types of chemicals, some extremely toxic. Now, in the case of this vaping craze that's going all over the country right now, especially among young people, it's also subject to the same kind of contamination and that other kinds of drugs are. So the ones that are being reported is creating these terrible respiratory illnesses that resulted in at least 5 deaths and now 450 people with severe respiratory infections, happening with people buying vaping products off the streets, not from a licensed FDA-approved vendor, basically, who has some kind of control over the kind of ingredients that go into them. And they have detected a chemical called vitamin E acetate that has been found in some of the more severe respiratory problems that have taken place with, as you reported, the THC. Now, vitamin E in itself, it's a water-soluble vitamin and can be a very beneficial product if it's taken orally, but if it's vaped, it can coat the lungs and it can create extreme respiratory problems, including wheezing, shortness of breath, and sometimes result in people not breathing at all. So I think it's they've got to get a grip on this as to what people are doing, where they're buying the products, and the kind of substances that are being added to these vaping products.
And John, you know how a non-smoker can get hit with secondhand smoke if they're around smokers. Is that the same case with somebody vaping? Can somebody get hit with the vaping fumes?
Oh, I don't think there's any question about it. Yeah, I mean, that vapor, that can be inhaled by anybody. But I think again, the difference between a water vapor you know, that may contain elements of this vitamin E acetate that I'm talking about, maybe some other chemicals, are not nearly as toxic as the kind of byproducts in cigarette smoke, which, you know, as you know, is secondhand smoke can be almost as bad as, you know, the person ingesting it themselves.
Okay, John, thank you so much. Dr. John Curtis, onlinecolumnist.com. It may be hard for non-pet owners to understand, but our cats and dogs cuddle their way into our hearts and quickly become beloved members of the family. It's incredibly common for pet owners to fall head over heels for their companions. But a new survey reveals that many actually favor their pets over their own children. According to the survey of 2,000 American pet-owning adults, 34% of the surveyed parents say their pet is their favorite child. India has lost control and contact with its unmanned lunar probe during the final moments of its attempt to land on the moon on Friday. The communication with the lander was lost just when it was 1.3 miles from the lunar surface. It's not clear if the mission has failed, they say, but they don't have any results yet. Boy, that would be disappointing. Peter Davenport's with the National UFO Reporting Center, and he's got his weekly report. What do you have for us, Peter?
George, well, my, what a week it has been. On more than one occasion, I think you've heard me say that I felt these UFOs are becoming more blatant, more overt, and showing themselves to human beings. I'm going to double down on that statement, I think, this week, and I think the five reports that I'd like to present tonight will vindicate my position on that.
Okay.
First one comes from Layden, Colorado, up in northwestern Denver. On Saturday of last week, the 31st of August, make that, a gentleman reports he had just dropped off a passenger, a paying fare. He's a professional taxi driver. And as he was driving away from the fare, his attention was drawn to a very peculiar-looking light in the night sky. He had the presence of mind to pull his taxi over and get about 2 minutes of video. I've looked at some of that video, and it is very dramatic. It is nothing more than a light, but it's a light that is dramatically moving across the sky, and I'm told by the source of that video that at 1 minute and 27 seconds into the video, you can see a second object shoot in from the northwest, drop down vertically, and then hover above ground level. Very interesting report. Second one is probably the capital report of the night. Tuesday of this past week, George, I received a telephone call from a gentleman who described himself as a husband, a father, a business owner, and a mortgage holder, and a bow hunter. This past Sunday, the 1st of September, he was out bow hunting near Taos, New Mexico, and with one of his other hunting partners, he saw two creatures standing on a hilltop, very alien-looking creatures. They were looking at them with binoculars. The next day, they went back to that area of the forest where they were hunting. I wouldn't have done that myself. But they went back, and they found a craft. They estimated it to be 100 feet long, resting on either the desert floor or wherever they were. I don't know what the terrain was like. So a very dramatic report. And I just discovered that both of those witnesses to that went in to talk to a member of the press in Taos, and there's going to be, a major article on it. Just briefly, three more reports. Omaha, Nebraska, this is Wednesday morning of this week, the 4th of September, gentlemen saw a boomerang-shaped object go right overhead. It went from horizon to horizon in about 7 seconds. Next report comes from Westminster, Colorado, up north of Denver. Gentlemen saw a rectangular object moving across the sky. Again, went from horizon to horizon in about 10 seconds. And final report comes from Kenosha, Wisconsin. This evening, two gentlemen saw a cluster of 5 or 6 or maybe 7 brightly lighted objects form a crescent in the night sky. They suddenly accelerated and disappeared from sight faster than their eyes could follow them. So there's a lot of activity taking place. And I remind people that the only way we can have these reports for sharing with others is if people submit them to the National UFO Reporting Center.
And Peter's website, ufocenter.com. Peter, thank you. We'll talk to you next week. Up next, we've got two special guests for the first half. John Semple joins us and then Jack Roth. They are award-winning producer and directors, and we're going to be talking with them about their latest film called Extraordinary, The Seeding. Wait till you hear what that's all about. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. We've got two special guests for you for this segment. This segment specifically, John Semple with us, an award-winning producer, director. Some of his works include Extraordinary, The Seeding, which we're going to talk about tonight. He's a writer by trade, filmmaker by night, along with his producing partners, Jack Roth, whom you'll hear from later on this hour, Jamie Cernoff and Lori Wagner. In addition to writing and filmmaking, he co-hosts a weekly baseball podcast. John, we're not a sports show, but I bet that's fun.
Yeah, it is. It's one of my side hobbies and the many things that I do to keep myself busy.
Favorite team, what is it?
I am partial to the Miami Marlins and Seattle Mariners. Spent time in both cities and was an avid Marlins fan in the early part of their since day one in 93. And when I moved out to Seattle in 2009, became a Mariners fan. Just a season ticket holder, enjoyed the two World Series with the Marlins, but became a Mariners fan as well. So I'd go back and forth between the two.
Whatever happened to my Detroit Tigers this year? My gosh.
Well, yeah, it's a starting over moment for them. And I feel bad for Ron Gardenhire, the manager, because he's inherited a very young and both young and old. Miggy Cabrera is old, and there's a lot of youngsters coming up. But there's future hope down the road.
Well, have fun doing that. That's cool. Good for you.
I appreciate it.
Good for you. And how did you make the transition into being a producer-director, especially doing documentaries on extraterrestrials?
It was Jack Roth kind of got me into it. We started in the paranormal world back in the mid-90s after he took a couple of photographs at a plantation in Louisiana that kind of kicked off a journey that led us into a couple of different projects that led us into this project. And it was really what really got us to this point was we received a lot of messages from people who were saying that they had seen our first film and they were curious as to why we were able to tell their story without us knowing about it. So they learned a lot of insight as a result of that, and we took the stories to heart. We heard from a lot of people saying, you know, our stories need to be heard. And as a result of that, we said it's time to start talking to some people about abduction stories, start talking to some people about hybridization stories. We started hearing some things from people back in like 2011, 2012, and we just started doing some research. We got connected to some people through Lori Wagner and Yvonne Smith and Chase Klotsky, and before we knew it, we had a long list of people that were experiencers who had unexplained pregnancy stories and sexual reproduction stories.
When you hear these stories, John, initially when you heard them, what did you think of the individuals? Did you think, yeah, well, I don't know about these folks, or were you so convinced that you jumped right into it?
Well, I think we got lucky. Because of the people who helped bring that first round of people to us, that they were kind of pre-qualified and screened in the sense that there was no people coming to us that had such far-fetched stories or seemed unstable. And I say that in all due respect because there are some people out there who have been traumatized by this in such a way that
Sure. It's
hard to determine whether or not their story is just their story or was it corroborated by anybody else. So those were challenges. And the other thing is that we heard a couple of the people that we screened, one of the first things they asked us was, well, how much am I going to get paid? And they were immediately dispatched from our list. It's not about that. It's about, you know, sharing your story in a way that will help other people.
Well, that's important, too. We're going to be hearing a little bit later on this hour with Jack Roth, and then John and Jack will be with us next hour for your phone calls as we talk about experiencers. Your personal belief surrounding the existence of extraterrestrials, does that affect your work, like extraordinary? Does it matter?
I think, you know, my background is I was born and raised in Newtown, Connecticut, which is well-documented, well-known for haunting. So I had this kind of predisposed notion to something that was otherworldly ever since I was a little kid growing up. And I had friends that had haunted, that lived in haunted houses, so I was familiar, you know, with that whole experience. And when I was in about 10, 11, 12 years old, I had three different sightings of craft in the sky. Two were reported by hundreds, if not one by hundreds, and another by thousands of people to the local police force. And then I saw another craft with a friend of mine. We were sitting on our front porch that was even closer than the first two that I had seen. The first two were lights in the sky. The last time, it was a craft that couldn't have been more than 400 or 500 yards away, and could see it plainly, the lights landing the forest in front of my house. So that was kind of like a connection to, you know, space. And my dad also, when I was growing up, worked on a project with NASA for the lunar module's landing light. So they were commissioned to work on that light. So he was big into the astronomy thing and the whole space program, and I got sucked into that when I was really young. So there was this predisposition at a very young age that anything was possible. I just kind of took that with me on this journey, and you know, our approach with this has been really to ask one simple question as we go through these investigations and interviews and presentation of the material is, what if it's all true?
Exactly.
Just to take it from that point of view is to say, you might not believe it. It's okay. You could be fiercely against it. That's okay. But what if it is all true? Let's have conversations from that perspective. You know, we don't have to, you know, yell and scream and shout at each other, but let's have conversation that can be productive if we open our minds to that simple question. What if it is all true? Because it changes everything if it is.
Sure does. John, a new study just came out, a new report from Gallup. A Gallup poll finds 68% of the Americans polled believe there is a UFO cover-up. 68%.
That's a big number. Yeah, that's a big number. And it's a big number. It's not a surprise. And I think the reason why it's not a surprise is because more and more information is coming out. And even though the government has released some information over the course of the last few years, starting in 2017 with the New York Times report, you know, people are, they're like, oh, wow, there's this kind of slow leak going on. But it's also presenting information in a way that it's like, yeah, we've known about this. So if they've known about it, why? It sounds like, well, why are they just coming out with it? Is there a reason? Was it going to be leaked? Was it going to make them look bad? So maybe, you know, even though it is becoming more common, maybe people are looking at it from the perspective of, well, what else do they know?
Well, exactly. And what I like about the Gallup poll is that it's wide-ranging. I mean, had they polled, for example, our audience on Coast to Coast, it probably would have skewed close to 90%, much higher.
Yeah.
But the fact that it's just a broad sample of people, 68% is, any presidential candidate would love that.
Yeah. But it's a good thing, though. That means that the conversation is moving from the fringes and into the masses. And it's the discussions won't be hush-hush. There'll be something that, you know, people will be more comfortable having those discussions, you know, at the lunchroom table at work and then at home with their families. And that to me, I think, is a really good thing.
John, what have you concluded about some of these abductees and experiencers? What has happened to them and why has it happened?
Well, the big question, I think, you know, with all of this is we don't purport to know the answers. We don't purport to say that, you know, we don't have an agenda that we're trying to, you know, push down people's throat. We're just posing that the stories that we've heard, there's a lot of commonality. There's corroborative reporting that should be considered evidence because so many people are sharing so many of the same things. So we need to start looking at it from that point of view. But the biggest thing that I've learned through all of this is that while I don't know what's happening to these people, something is happening to them. Something is happening that's so profound that it's having an emotional impact on them to the point where some people are suffering from PTSD. So I know people are quick to judge, and you might see a small clip of a video or a photograph, or, you know, read a short social media post and judge that person based on that one thing. But you really need to peel back the layers of the onion. You really need to get into their story. You need to learn more about what they've been through, and you need to have conversations with
absolutely
them.
and their life too. John, we're going to bring you back for phone calls next hour. Up next, your partner Jack Roth joins us to talk about Extraordinary, the Seeding. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. In a moment, Jack Roth joins us as we talk about their work in the ET world. Fascinating. And then we'll take your calls with both of them next hour with John Semple as well on Coast to Coast. Tim Banal, of course, is the news editor of our coasttocoastam.com website and puts together some amazing stories. And Timothy, what have you put together for us this week?
Hey, George. How you doing? Good to talk to you again.
You too.
The big story of the week. Now, I know you mentioned this at the start of the show last night, but I kind of wanted to double down on it a little bit. And this was the DNA study
of Loch Ness. Yes, great story.
Yes, I was like a kid on Christmas morning on this one, because I remember when it was first announced. We covered it at the Coast website when it was first announced in April of 2017. So I've been following this for the last 2.5 years, and it was kind of bittersweet story to write. For folks who don't know the background of this. A geneticist from New Zealand and a team of researchers, they took 250 water samples from all throughout Loch Ness. And then they sent these to labs around the world, and they extracted what's called environmental DNA. This is all like flecks of skin and scales and all kinds of stuff that's left behind by different creatures in the water. And then they took the DNA that was in that and compared it to global databases of genetic, information on all the different creatures we have, all the stuff we know. So they compared it to what we know and we have in there. And they found, incredibly, that there were no sharks, catfish, or sturgeon. They were managed to knock out all the big sort of suspects, if you will, for the Loch Ness Monster. And, of course, unfortunately, they didn't find any. They said nothing that's even remotely related to a plesiosaur, which is kind of, that's why I said it was kind of a bittersweet story,
yeah,
in a sense. But I think it narrowed it down pretty well. I mean, this is about as close as we may get to the case being closed on the Loch Ness Monster, short of, you know, draining the water there. They think, you know, the most plausible possibility for this is an eel. They found so much eel DNA in the water. They said it was pretty much at every location they sampled, there was eel DNA. So it would seem to be that, the theory that's been kind of kicked around for a long time, especially in recent years, that it's an eel, that seems to be, you know, as close as we might get to a final answer here on the Loch Ness Monster.
That's a big eel, Tim.
Absolutely, yeah. That's that's quite the eel. Now we just gotta, you know, I guess pull one out of the water or something. But
exactly.
Yeah, that seems to be it. But you know, the Loch Ness Monster will never die. I think the idea will carry on forever. And the advertising agents and stuff like that—they're not going to change the drawing of the Loch Ness Monster to an eel. It's always going to be what we all kind of pictured in our minds, which is the dinosaur in the water.
That's Tim Banal, our editor at CoastToCoastAM.com. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. Now here's the other half of the team, Jack Roth with us, award-winning writer. Jack's journalism background prepared him to view ufology through a discerning lens while keeping an open mind to the possibility that we are not alone. Hey, Jack, welcome to the program.
Hi, George. Thanks for having me.
Looking forward to this. And then John's going to join you next hour with phone calls as we chat with our listeners about not only your work, Extraordinary, the Seeding, but maybe some of the own things they've gone through. When you got into this, Jack, did it change your mind about anything?
Well, I was fairly open-minded about the possibility of ET presence, the possibility that obviously we're not alone in the universe, that kind of thing. And but in really talking to all the people we spoke to, the experiencers, I realized that there was really something going on, and it was much closer than just seeing a light in the sky and trying to determine whether or not they were manned by extraterrestrial beings. I think it brought it a lot closer to home, you know, because you're talking to people who have had profound experiences, and traumatic experiences and close encounters, literally. And it makes you realize that there's a lot more probably going on than we really know.
And I suspect it's been going on for a long, long time. How about you?
Yeah, I do too. You know, we talk about the modern age of ufology, you know, starting with Roswell, right after World War II. And, you know, we always think that that's when it all started. But if you really do the research, you realize that if there's DNA manipulation occurring, hybridization programs, whatever they might be, it could go back thousands of years.
Yeah, absolutely. Tell us a little bit about the title, Extraordinary the Seeding.
Sure. Well, Extraordinary is part of our, you know, we kind of branded the series of films that we're going to be making Extraordinary. And the Seeding, you know, it fits because the people are being seeded. You know, we spoke to dozens and dozens of women who talked about being abducted and some kind of experiments that were happening to them that related to reproduction, and all of a sudden they're pregnant. And so they're being seeded with something by something, and then during the course of perhaps towards the end of the first trimester of these pregnancies, the child was gone. Their pregnancy was terminated. And it's just this very strange kind of experience. And what was really interesting about it is we were talking to all these women. They kind of told the same story. It was the same thing was happening to all of them. So we thought that the seeding was appropriate because that was obviously a big part of what the abduction experience is.
Could you tell, Jack, that by interviewing these individuals that there was some definitive truth behind all of this?
Yeah, and, you know, that's a great question because a lot of people, if you just hear about it, because, well, that's just a story. Someone's telling a story. I don't know if I believe that. And that's a valid point. It's a valid point of view. But when you're in front of people and you're in front of tens and dozens of people and you see them, they're looking at you and they're telling us their stories, and you see the anxiety, you sense the fear, you sense the vulnerability, you sense the isolation, and you know they're telling the truth. You know that what they're telling you is something that they are legitimately experiencing and have experienced. You see it in a whole new different light, and you just feel like, you know what, that they believe that this is happening to them at the very least.
They do, and you could tell that they are truly upset about most of the things that have happened to them, haven't they?
Right, exactly, and it is. It's traumatic. And many of them actually have. They're diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder. And in the same way that a soldier coming back from war is diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder. So whatever's happening to them is, again, it's such a profoundly traumatic experience that they're actually having a disorder. They have a disorder over it. So, and that's, I think that's what really hit us the hardest. Was, you know, when you're a documentary, when you're a filmmaker, you're not sure where the story is going to go. And you think you know what the story is. But after talking to all these people, we realized the story was it's them, it's their experiences, it's what they're going through. And whether or not it's happened to us, we should empathize a little bit with them because they really are, they're going through a lot and they are suffering in many cases.
Could you relate to us perhaps one or two stories that you have in Extraordinary the Seeding that just simply blew your mind?
Yeah, and there were several, but I think that the one that I really that stood out to me was this one particular individual. Her name's Sierra Neblina. She's in the film, and her story is interesting because she is she's a lifelong lesbian. She's never been with a man, never slept with a man in her entire life, and she was in a committed relationship with her partner. And all of a sudden, she had this abduction type of experience, and next thing you know, she's pregnant. Now, here's Whoa. A woman who's never been with a man, who now has to tell her partner, "I'm pregnant."
By an ET.
Exactly, and so her partner's like, well, you know, as much as she's open-minded and wants to believe it, in the back of her mind, it creeps in that she must have slept with some guy.
You would think so.
Right. You know,
I mean, logic would tell you that. Now, how did the partner react eventually? Did she go to accept this?
Well, it eventually caused a rift in the relationship, and it did not work out.
It fell apart.
It happens a lot with people, not only with just boyfriends and girlfriends, but with husbands and wives. Marriages are destroyed over this, and you know, when people have kids and they get divorced. She did not. She was unable to really come to terms with that because she couldn't. And the way Sierra described it, that her partner, she just could not. Although she thought it was possible, when it's confronting you like that, she was like, "No, it can't be possible. You had it cheated on me." I mean, you know, it sounds trite, but at the same time, there's human beings. These are human beings going through their human emotions, you know, and it's very difficult. It's very difficult for people to deal with.
I had a story on Open Lines years ago, and a lady had called in to tell us a story about her husband who never comes home late, ever comes home late. Well, he did this time, and his story was that he was abducted by ETs. And she said, "George, he was nervous, he was sweaty, and do you know what else these ETs did to him?" And I went, "Oh, no, don't say it on the radio." She said, "They took his wedding ring." And after that, I just kind of stopped and went, "Oh, no, here's a guy who used that as an excuse, took his ring off, and forgot to put it back on."
Right.
Yet he used that as an excuse, abducted by ETs, and she accepted it.
Right.
He's probably listening right now.
That was bold of him on his part, you know. But again, in Sierra's case, she legitimately, obviously, she was impregnated. So there it was. I mean, she was pregnant.
Now, was the baby taken?
Now, yes, the baby was taken towards the end of the first trimester. She had another abduction experience, and then the baby was taken. And there was no evidence whatsoever of a miscarriage. And that's when she started to look for answers. Because she was in the military. And she's a go-getter. She's a pretty tough girl. And she was like, "I want answers. This is not acceptable to me." And it kind of sent her down this path of discovery of trying to find out who did this to me, why they did this to me. But, yeah, she never, after that, and that was it. The baby was gone, and she never, you know, obviously there was no communication with the child after that. She never, that was it. It was just, doctors said it was a miscarriage, but couldn't explain how it happened or why it happened. But she knew better. She knew that something had happened because she'd had the abduction experience along with it.
We're with Jack Roth, one of the partners in the upcoming film documentary Extraordinary, The Seeding. We'll tell you where you can watch that eventually, too. Next hour, John Semple, his other partner, joins him back, and we'll take phone calls. I've always thought that the hybridization program was based on several possible theories, Jack. Let's get your thoughts. One, that they're just doing it to come back and repopulate planet Earth eventually because they know something's going to happen, and they want it to survive, and they want to bring all these people or individuals back as really a new civilization. So there's that possibility. The other one I thought about was they want to take over the planet with these trained hybrids and get rid of all of us. So that's another possibility. Three, there are other planets similar to Earth, and these hybrids are populating those planets. Maybe they're doing it that way, or they need it for their own purposes on their own planet. What do you think?
Yeah, and those are all really valid possibilities. And I thought through, too. We've had discussions, John and I and the rest of the crew. And you know what? I think it could very well be a combination of all three of those things. We don't know for sure. But I tend to, you know, the optimist in me wants to think that this is somehow the next step in our evolution as humans. That this is going, they're helping us get.
That it's a positive thing. David Jacobs would think otherwise.
Would absolutely think otherwise. You know, total colonization, this is not good for us at all, and they will eventually take over and be what's left on this planet.
Huge ships will show up one day, and we're toast.
Exactly. And he's done a lot of, he's done 50 years of research on this, and he's convinced. So, you know, it's a little unnerving the more and more you learn about this. It is unnerving because you realize that there is something, at least part of it, at the very least, is very insidious.
Yes.
It really is.
Why would an advanced civilization want to do us in? What do they get out of it?
Yeah, see, that's why that's the ray of hope I have, is that that doesn't make sense. I would think more that either they are trying to populate maybe another planet, and maybe there's something wrong with their species is dying out, so they're trying to create a hybrid species that can populate another planet and survive on that planet. And maybe we share this planet. Again, this is the next step in human evolution. And maybe they've been doing this, like I said, we talked about earlier, if they've been doing it for 100,000 years or 40,000 years or whatever, since there were primates here, maybe this has all been a part of that process.
Do you remember that Nicolas Cage movie? I can't remember the title, where he was at a time capsule event for his school.
Yeah, Knowing. Was it Knowing?
It might have been that. His little boy was there. And,
yeah.
And the bottom line is ETs were following the little boy and the little girl to take them off the planet and bring them back because there was going to be a catastrophe that would literally annihilate planet Earth, and every living species was dead. But they wanted to repopulate the planet at the right time, and they did.
They did. It was like Noah's Ark.
Yes. All over again with high technology. And that's a possibility, too.
Yeah, I mean, it's scary to think, but look what we've done to this planet. I mean, things aren't that great right now. So, I mean, if you think about it that way, if you think about it objectively, if you think about it logically, you have to kind of at least be open to the possibility that, yeah, this might be the case.
What do you think most of those abductees who have been going through this think is happening? What do they think happened to their child?
Well, I think a lot of them, everyone has to try to come to terms with the experience they're having, and people deal with that in different ways. And a lot of people have come to terms with it thinking that, well, I think the children, you know, it again, it's the next phase in our evolution, and that it's a good thing. It's a good thing for humanity.
Interesting. Jack, we're going to bring John back in, both of you. We'll take phone calls next on Coast to Coast AM.